This is Citizen Reporter, the podcast that listens and learns about the world through many different topics. I'm sort of a Renaissance person. Is that still a thing? Someone who's interested in many things? If you're interested in many different topics, then this is the right podcast for you. Certainly the right podcast for me. I'm Mark Fonseca Rendeiro, and at the close of last year, I know, we're in 2018, but I have a few things that I never got to put out. I got busy. Life pulled me in so many directions, trying to survive. Let's call it survival, yes. At the end of last year, I spoke with Mike Spine, my friend, the great musician who occasionally finds himself in Amsterdam. And on this particular occasion that I had not yet published, Mike came to the kitchen table for a kitchen table conversation. These are also published on Realities Podcast, which I'm slowly pushing over here towards CTRP. So if you're subscribed here, you're going to get to hear all those interviews, including some that are yet unpublished. So here's Mike Spine at the kitchen table talking music, society, the life, as we call it. Yeah, let's listen. Hello, welcome to another live podcast, Realities. We're here in Amsterdam in the kitchen, at the kitchen table, and sitting right there, you can't miss him, that's Mike Spine. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
So, Mike, you're in town at the end of a tour here.
Yes, we just finished up a little two-week tour playing a bunch of shows with our friends called Del Vox. They normally play as a full band, but they were just over as a duo.
Yeah,
with Barbara and I also touring as a duo, so it was nice to have some other Seattleites in town and be able to share a stage instead of having to sometimes play for 3 hours a night.
Yeah, I also find there's that nice connection, or at least in my mind, between Seattle and Amsterdam. I don't know if it's musically or just in attitude wise.
Yeah, I think there's within the context of the word liberal or progressive, there's some, I would say, overlaps, you know, in terms of political thoughts or, they're both hyper-capitalist
societies. Right, I was going to say, is that like the way they used to be, of them?
Yeah, but, you know, you can smoke marijuana in both cities now.
That's so, right.
Yeah, Washington, Oregon, California, I think most of the West Coast.
Colorado
for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe Nevada.
Have you been through, you've been in Washington since the change in policy.
Yes.
Yeah. But you're not, I mean, you spend more of your year in Italy?
Yeah. Barbara's from Milan. And Italy has this wonderful thing called national health insurance.
Well,
And that's not currently available in the United States unless you are rich or poor. It's easier to be there related to immigration and cost of living. Seattle's become extremely expensive, and unless you're making $100,000 a year, it's a pretty tough place to live.
Yeah. So, and how does it feel in terms of? I mean, it's been a few years now, right?
I think around 3 years.
Yeah. And how does it feel in terms of music? I mean, everyone probably has heard something of like the Seattle scene and different scenes when it comes to music. But okay, there you are in Milan area?
Yeah, we're in the Milan metropolitan area, which is a large, sprawling area.
Yeah?
Yeah. I would say, you know, Italy's economy suffered after the economic crisis, they like to call it, in 2008.
Yeah.
And hasn't really rebounded in the way that I would say Germany's economy or Netherlands' economy has. So there's a lot of businesses that are struggling. Yeah. I think the tax structure is challenging. I think the income, there are definitely people in Milan who make a lot of money and it's got a wealth in it, but it has a pretty big divide between the low-end workers and the high-end workers. So I think a lot of clubs are struggling there. But people are very passionate about music, and there's some great music there. It's, I mean, throughout the country, I've been fortunate to travel all the way down to Sicily touring, and yeah. We've met great people and great bands all along the way. So,
So in that sense, you're not losing out when it comes to, or you don't feel like you're losing out when it comes to exposure to other musicians or audiences?
Yeah, maybe a little.
What sense?
I don't know if it's, you know, it's, there are definitely bands that tour there, but I wouldn't say as many probably go through there as go through Seattle or Portland.
Oh, right.
Or,
okay.
You know, yeah. I mean,
I get that feeling just in Amsterdam. I mean, lots of bands come through here,
yeah.
But compared to New York,
sure.
It's different.
Yeah.
Or what often happens on tours, and you played a show 2 days ago at this point over the weekend in Harlem.
Yeah.
Which is, a lot of people still don't know about Harlem in the Netherlands.
Very nice. I would recommend
it. I mean, no offense to Harlem, but it's a bedroom community for Amsterdam, although that's changing, right? Some people obviously work and live there, but it's just 10 minutes outside. So you played there, and I see often that in my opinion, great musicians such as yourself will be in the country and even play shows, but it may not be in Amsterdam, actually.
Yeah.
For reasons that maybe I haven't really sat and thought about, but simply that the connections don't come through the opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it may be with the density of Amsterdam, challenges with space and noise, too, in terms of venues, but yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't know the venue scene well enough here to comment on it, but yeah. I think that's a problem in a lot of cities, especially cities that draw a tourist crowd yeah. in. You know, the neighbors are get pretty wary of
always angry. Noise. My neighbors are probably angry right now. We just hold it in. That's also very, believe it or not, there's something very Dutch about that, or at least Amsterdam about it. Like, you hate on your neighbor, but you may not say it this week or this month.
I see.
It comes out in weird ways eventually, though.
Right.
Yeah. It's passive aggressive. That's the okay. one I'm looking for. Hello, passive aggressives, neighbors. But yeah, yeah. Well, you get a mix actually in this town. You get the, I'm going off on a tangent, but you get the neighbors who, so there was a great jazz club. It still is. The Bim House.
Okay.
Right. Bim House is a beautiful, next time you come to town, we'll go,
great.
Especially on a Tuesday night, they do, and I know you were thinking of just lingering. They do, it's a conservatory night where the students from the conservatory can play or nice. Anyone. Anyone can just stroll up, play. Great. I have. And now it's in a beautiful location. It was specially designed in the early 2000s,
okay.
and it's on the water. It's there's no apartments next to it.
Yeah.
But for many years, but several decades, it was right in a residential neighborhood, pretty near Central Station.
Right.
And actually, that neighborhood wasn't even residential. Once upon a time, I think it was warehouses. Right. And I remember just learning the city and learning how things work here, and going to that club. And being so excited because it was a jazz club. It's the Bim House. It's where all the big jazz musicians would come, and I'd get right. to see them. And but I also remember they had a problem, which was neighbors as of a certain hour would complain about a jazz club,
right.
Too many people hanging out, loud music,
yeah.
which is hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
And sure enough, within a few years, I mean, maybe the plan was long in the making, but that club moved.
Right.
You know, the people were more powerful than the club that had been there before the people. I guess this yeah. is a standard story now in our world.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of condos being built in Seattle in neighborhoods that traditionally had very vibrant music scenes and bar scenes. And, you know, people don't like it when people get out of a club at 2 a.m. and, you know, are drunk and hollering and.
Yeah.
But, you know, that then don't move into that neighborhood.
Right.
You know. That's what the neighborhood is or was.
Was, right. So. That's the thing. It's what it was, right? So you suddenly find yourself not in the position of power as, I guess, a club owner or a music lover. I don't know. But then again, that said, I'm easily forgetting the fact that there are tons of people still who are very let it ride kind of attitude.
Sure.
My downstairs neighbor, who probably hears me right now, he never complains about anything. And there are a lot of parties over here in the yard.
Okay.
Well, there have been anyway. And I said to him the other day, like, oh, didn't that party the other day bother you? And he goes, nah, it's just people having a good time. Nice. You should join them. If you don't like it, maybe you'll like it better.
Nice.
And I was like, oh, I almost forgot that was an attitude. Yeah. Like you can just soak it all in, enjoy it.
Yeah.
So on this particular tour, there was the Netherlands.
Yep. Germany.
Germany.
And then we're going for 6 weeks back through Italy.
Oh, okay. That's still to come.
So yeah, this is the northern climate.
Yeah.
Portion, and then we return back for slightly warmer weather for a little while.
Right. What's left of summer has got to be down there somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. So that'll be Italy, including southern Italy?
We're still figuring out some of that. I think most of it is north central right now.
Okay. Yeah, even in terms of music, I mean, I guess audiences, clubs, that'll all change as you move around.
Yeah, actually, this is actually, I think, common throughout a lot of Europe. In the summertime, a lot of venues actually shut down unless they're very large venues.
Okay.
Because, like in Berlin, they told us, you know, everybody wants to be outside as soon as the sun comes. Nobody wants to go sit in a smoky bar the way they would have done that in November when it was pouring rain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Italy's similar, you know, everybody goes to the beach in the summer. So people are fleeing the hot cities to go to the beach. So maybe there's clubs that shift and, you know, you have beach clubs that open for
two or three outdoor months. Scene.
Yeah.
Here it's the festivals.
Right.
About the festivals.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Portugal too. Portugal gets really into the festivals, although those festivals are massive commercial enterprises. So getting on a bill seems difficult.
Yeah, we've played a few, but not the ones sponsored by Heineken.
No.
Well, maybe they were, but not, you know, not with 100,000 people at them.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just thinking, actually, in Portugal, one of the largest festivals, I mean, there are, I guess, larger now, but it's still the one run by the Communist Party.
Really?
Yeah. It's called Avant. I never fully understood it. Nelson's there. Maybe Nelson knows. It was a fundraiser essentially for the Communist Party, which has and had representation, and it ran certain municipalities. Yeah. So it's a legit party. But it was funny because out of all the political parties, I don't know that any was as famous for running a big ass music festival. Yeah. Where I guess between like Metallica or whoever, I don't know if they ever got Metallica, but close, I'm sure. I guess there may have been a speech about workers' rights.
Right.
But mostly the people that I knew that would go to that festival knew nothing of the Communist Party. Right. They were just like, yeah, good party. Good festival.
Yeah, we see festivals like that in Italy too.
Yeah.
The CP still has a strong presence.
In the music scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, the way things go in our world of retaining attention and getting people to listen, if it ever seemed weird, it seems less weird these days, like any way you can to get people to hear you.
Yeah.
Because nobody seems to hear anybody. I don't know. Yeah. Being heard is such a difficult thing in that sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those of us just joining on the live stream, obviously it's another live podcast. Mike Spine is here, wonderful musician. Barbara Luna is guarding the stuff somewhere, but she's also on this tour. And I'll definitely get you guys both at the table next time and we can tell stories.
She's actually deathly shy of interviews. So.
I had a feeling.
She's like, Gringo, you go talk. You go talk. I'm not going. But she would have liked to have said hi.
Yeah.
See you.
Yeah. I was wondering something like, so you and I, we often talk about teaching actually. So besides, you know, performing and touring, which is a big part of your existence, especially the last, can I say 20 years?
Yeah, you can.
I've heard about those times. Actually, it started in the 90s for you, didn't it?
Yeah, I think 95 was when I started playing in rock punk bands.
Yeah. And at the same time, or around the same time, teaching was also a thing for you. I mean, was that just a matter of, I need something that fits with playing music? How did that begin?
I had always been pretty passionate about social change, mm-hmm. you know, social, economic, environmental kind of justice issues. And I was trying to find a way to be able to do that.
Hmm.
And make a living, you know, because Actually, my undergraduate degree was in mass media and rhetoric.
Oh, okay.
So I wanted to
right
be,
place.
I wanted to be a kind of make documentaries, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. I mean,
for a pop reference, Michael Moore style.
Sure. You know, which was of, in the 90s, especially very yeah. inspiring.
Yeah, I haven't seen his work in a long time, but.
Yeah, yeah.
But trying to be an independent filmmaker back in that era was not a sustainable.
Yeah.
I mean, I met the guys that made Manufacturing Consent, the Noam Chomsky documentary.
Yeah, yeah.
And because I was very into his work and his, you know, analysis of media with Edward Herman.
Yeah.
And you know, they were Canadian guys and they had gotten a bunch of money from the Canadian government to make Manufacturing Consent. And, you know, it took years of their lives. And, you know, there were U.S. filmmakers, I think it was a question answer, you know,
style, yeah.
The thing that was going on. And yeah, they were, the Americans were like, well, we can't get any money to do this. We can barely, you know, feed ourselves. So I did some work around affordable housing. I was living in Portland at the time and I was trying to get affordable housing built for low income people and also helped form a tenants union because Oregon was and continues to be going through a rapid escalation of housing prices. And and so a lot of people were getting, you know, evicted by their landlords and there was no real way that tenants could advocate for themselves. So we built a tenants union, first tenant union in Oregon.
Wow.
And then I liked the work that I was doing, but it was very isolated. It was an office kind of sitting in.
There's a certain degree of admin.
Yeah, a lot of, you know, I was doing meetings and organizing stuff, but then I was also spending a lot of time at a computer in an office with one other person or two other people, and it was not very rewarding in a social interaction, humanistic sort of way. So I had a friend that was working at an alternative school for immigrant refugee dropout population, basically kids that had been kicked out of or failed out of other schools in Portland. Mm-hmm. And they were hiring a teacher assistant position and they hired me on. And at the time there were no regulations related to certification or anything like that, in the early 90s in alternative schools. And so I ended up teaching classes, even though I'd been hired as an assistant. So, it was a great school. I spent about 5 years there. I had a lot of autonomy.
Yeah, that's key.
It was tough, but I felt like, you know, I was able to connect with the students and and have some meaningful and engaged learning stuff happening. Tried to do a lot of experiential education too, taking kids out.
And you have and again trips. With that autonomy, you could
So that was great.
Let me put this,
but
just a little closer. Yeah,
sure, but. But it was a challenge too, you know, breaking up fights and gunshots and, you know, things like that.
Yeah. So you have people who are both very, very interested and engaged. And I suppose also people who have a lot of more things going on in their lives. And
yeah. Just dealing with the, you know, the nonsense of gang wars and who's got blue and red on and, you know.
This is one of those moments where if I go, yeah, I know. It might not seem, but
yeah,
I am from Newark, but man, was our neighborhood nice. Yeah. Or people were nice to each other. I don't know. Anyway.
But you know the general story.
Yeah.
It's
I think I do. Yeah.
People fighting over neighborhoods where they don't own a brick of the block.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like,
that's what humans do. We often harm each other over very little, or at least in terms of the immediate stakes.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I left that position to move to New York City, and I was working in a program called the New York City Teaching Fellows. And what they did was put people who had little or no teaching experience into schools that were called hard to staff schools. So they were basically schools where they couldn't get people to go or stay.
Yeah.
And so I ended up in the South Bronx in the poorest congressional, most violent, poorest congressional district in the United States. And that was, I was teaching seventh grade language arts social studies sort of stuff. And it was pretty difficult.
Seventh grade, so 13, 12?
They were supposed to be about 13, but like, I had 14 and 15-year-olds that hadn't, they wouldn't pass out. If they couldn't pass the test, they wouldn't move them up out of the grade. So I had, those were my, generally my most difficult students were the ones who were 15 and just waiting to turn 16 so they could drop out because the police would bring them back to school if they, you know, didn't come to school.
Oh, right.
It's so.
Truancy.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And around when was that, New York City?
That was my first week of teaching was when 9/11 happened.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
just to add, just to add to the excitement of an already challenging job.
Yeah. Yeah. In the Bronx. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Sure. Yeah. So 2011. No, what am I saying? 9/11.
2001.
2001.
Yeah.
10 years off.
Yeah. Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah. No, no, no. We know
time flies,
what you mean.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Can you tweet? I'm going to read some of the comments now. Now comes the section of the show. Orshi, who's right around the corner, Can you tweak Mike's mic? Ah, yeah, we can tweak Mike's mic. Here's what I'm going to do, because we talk to each other. I'm going to move it towards where he projects his voice. And this is all going to work.
All right.
Yeah.
Now I can hide behind the microphone.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And then earlier, Aaron had said hello to you.
Aaron.
Don't ask me for last names because it's already scrolled down. So it's
all right. Hello, Aaron.
Yeah, there you go. I think it was Aaron. Yeah.
All right.
Anything else? We'll take your comments as we go. There's a couple of thumbs. I think that means something in this new language. Thumbs.
Maybe that means they can hear me now.
Thumbs. Thumbs. If you didn't hear anything of what Mike said, you can listen to the podcast, which is in your podcast directory if you use podcasts at all, and it's just called Realities. Or you can write my name, since we're friends, probably. It's Mark Fonseca Rendeiro, and you'll find the show or other shows. But Mike Spine's here today, and that's a thing that only happens about once a year, depending on the year.
Yeah.
You're threatening to be back in the spring.
I would like to be back in the spring.
Yeah.
Yeah. The goal is for the next Northern Europe tour to be in the spring.
Yeah. And by the way, so when it comes to somewhat close the book on teaching, although is it really closed nowadays, do you still dabble anything in education?
Not other than
you ever teach music?
I have taught a little bit of music. I'm not a formally trained musician.
That would have been the first question I should have put together. Yeah.
I've done some songwriting workshop shops that I liked. I've taught guitar classes. But I'm not conservatory trained. So there are elements of music which I can teach, and there are elements which like music theory is not something that I love or care about.
Yeah.
So
what did understanding that you weren't formally educated in music, but who or what did you learn from? We're about to embark on a probably very long list, but I'll take your time. Especially because, you know, I was just, this morning I was listening to Tom Petty.
Oh, yes.
And I was like, you know, how much did I learn from Tom Petty? Not just about music.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got a guitar from my uncle when I was 8. Mm-hmm. I took some very simple kind of folk guitar lessons at a music store for a couple of years.
A music store.
Yeah, I had to drive to the music store to take take lessons in the back room. His name was Big Al.
Big, it was actually called Big Al's Music?
No, I don't remember. It might have been called Kennelly Keys or something, I don't remember. Mm-hmm. I think it was a small chain throughout Seattle, still around maybe.
Yeah.
Not where I live, but so I did that for a couple of years, and then I got an electric guitar from my cousin, and so I started experimenting more with kind of rock bar chord sort of stuff. Mostly just learning from friends, and maybe I took one guitar class in high school.
Yeah.
But I mean, the people who were, this was the era of Eddie Van Halen,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it was the guitar god sort of, era of how fast you can play and technical you can play. And that wasn't really my thing.
Oh, okay. I was wondering if you went down that road for a little while.
No, no. I mean, you know, I get by, but I'm mm-hmm. not, I will never be a guitar legend.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't compete with those people in high school. And it kind of got me, when I got out of high school and I got to university, and especially when I was in Portland, I guess I discovered a band called Fugazi around when I was 18. And I really liked what they were doing because I'd grown up on the Dead Kennedys and some of this, you know, other punk earlier, 7 Seconds. And I liked how Fugazi was able to make intelligent political songs, but also very intriguing music that was complicated and intricate, but not in a, you know, technical virtuoso sort of way.
It wasn't over your head or anyone's head. Yeah.
So, I started going to punk shows and house concerts and things that, you know, were pretty rare in the suburbs of Seattle when I was a teenager. You know, there would be, it'd be pretty rare if something like that happened. A scene started to flourish right as I graduated, in terms of a kind of independent music venue that was doing a lot of interesting stuff.
Is that mid-90s?
I graduated high school in 1990. Right after that. So, you know, it was a vibrant time for music in Seattle and Portland and I think, you know, the whole West Coast. And I mean, it was the kind of the explosion of, you know, Nirvana and all these bands in that similar kind of era who were taking elements of punk and mixing them with rock and pop and, you know, maybe, you know, taking the energy of the Clash and maybe polishing it into a little different kind of song format or something that that was catchy. So anyway, there was a lot of great, incredible music going on and I was watching the shows and I was like, I can do this. You know, I'd actually taken 2 years of jazz guitar while I was in university, my last 2 years. And I was not proficient in jazz in any way, but I learned how to make some different chords and I guess the little bit I gained of my knowledge of music theory came probably in that era. So
it's that useful knowledge that you then put together with all the other stuff that you pick
up. Yeah. It took me a while to kind of paste everything together. I mean, I didn't really.
For a while,
I was trying to make music that was overly complicated.
Sure.
Because I didn't want to just make bar chords.
Be respected and such.
I didn't want to just have a major minor chord.
Okay.
But the songwriting was suffering. So at some point I had a friend who's a poet, author, lives in Mexico now. He used to live in Seattle. And he said, you know, I like what you're doing, but your songwriting you need more poetry, you know, kind of in your, like you can have political content, but you need to do it in a smarter way.
Right.
And also the songs, I think, just needed to shift out of this, like, oh, I can play this fancy 13th chord.
Yeah.
But the average, the listener doesn't care if you're playing a 13th chord. They just care if the song is something they want to hum along with and interest them, you know.
Does it get them? Yeah. Silver birds set fly through cactus that is baked in sun. Vicious looking scorpions, vultures coast Pacific breeze, over hardened knotted trees, flying on their 6 foot wings, looking for a meal that's free. Gone to the 13th chords, but we get a question from the audience here. Mike, can you explain the Seattle freeze?
Oh, we have a Seattle.
He went to visit, I think.
Do we know Patrick?
I definitely grew up with him in Union, New Jersey, but he is a bi-coastal traveler.
All right.
So you never know.
The Seattle freeze, as it is known, is kind of the concept that people are cold in Seattle, or at least maybe on the surface friendly, but there's kind of a wall that's there.
Yeah.
But I have to say that coming from my childhood, my experience in Seattle, I never felt that.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that I don't know if that is something that came more as tons of people started to move to Seattle in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Because in the 70s, you know, there was billboards up like the last person out of Seattle, turn out the lights. You know, it was...
I'm going to make that the album art for today's podcast.
It was a depressed economy.
Okay.
And...
That can change behavior.
And, you know, as Microsoft grew and Seattle suddenly became on the map with the music scene, a lot of people moved to Seattle. And I don't know if that's, I don't know if, when I think of myself, my friends, my family, I feel like there's not a freeze.
Yeah.
So I don't know exactly where that came from.
Hmm. Yeah. No, yeah, he mentions Patrick here responding. It was where you went on your honeymoon in May, Patrick. I do recall this conversation that you were heading there. And he says that that's what they kept saying, that about that there was such a thing as a Seattle freeze. But every single person I met was super friendly.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of how it works. I don't know. There, I think also economics is an interesting factor, history. But also, I think, you know, I'm going to go out on a strange limb, but temperature, you know, here, which if we can compare it due to rain and perhaps economic prosperity now, but Amsterdam has for visitors, still, we'll see what happens, but still a pretty positive reputation in terms of, never mind what you can do here, that's plenty of things, but also that people are pretty friendly.
Yeah.
When you need something or just... Hey, you know,
yeah.
I wouldn't say they're overly friendly. They're just, they're cool. They're
adequately
relaxed.
Friendly.
Yeah. Yeah. But if you linger here for any amount of time, you will encounter what you might call a freeze, which is that at first it's hard to get into a circle of friends. Actually, okay. Not just at first, maybe for quite a while.
Yeah.
They'll know you, but are you invited? I'm still never invited to, we have it's not Christmas, it's St. Nicholas or Sinterklaas. I'm never invited to Sinterklaas. That's a family thing.
Oh, okay.
Now, there are friends who do this together. Oh, I guess we did it once, dear friends. It's pretty rare. And that tells me, well, at the very least, I don't have family in this country,
right.
Which is a fact. On the other side, it's also the limitations of how much people can let you in or will let you in, though I'm not staking everything on being part of this very irritating holiday where I have to write poems. And then a small... black man is paraded around still, but you know all that story anyway.
Yeah, I don't know that story.
Oh,
but it's
you know of.
I mean, I've
Santa
seen
Santa Claus has a slave, but the Dutch insist it's not a slave. How about that?
That's
the really
that's
brief
challenging
version.
That's challenging.
Yeah. And they insist that it's just a person that's covered in soot, and so people run around in black makeup on that holiday, which is coming up. So, but it's on the way out in terms of a practice, but there are lots of people that will defend it until the end and will get mad at the words I just used because they'll insist there is no racism in this country and that is not a racist act.
Sure.
But there we come to something else, which is this whole how we see ourselves and believe ourselves
right.
to be good people. Therefore, we couldn't possibly do anything wrong.
Right.
Yeah. So Seattle.
It's familiar.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, as someone who spent a lot of time in public schools, in poor communities, working with people who are very oppressed, exploited, however you want to, you know, describe that, I think people in Seattle sort of romanticize that it's a progressive liberal city.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I think that maybe in a libertarian way, where it's like, okay, if you're gay and you want to have gay sex, that's okay,
mm-hmm.
right? Or if you want to smoke weed, you know, like, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get into kind of deeper structural situations or institutional racism or, you know, it's a hyper-capitalist society there. It's, you know, the developers and the corporations have total control of the economy and, you know, there's... I think between 10 and 12,000 homeless people in Seattle now because people simply can't afford to live there. And it's one of the richest cities with some of the biggest corporations in the world there. You know, Amazon has, I think 30,000 employees, you know, now in Seattle and billions of dollars. And they have very little social consciousness and are doing very little to assist in what I feel like they should be doing with the amount of money they have in terms of, you know, helping folks
yeah.
out.
Yeah. Well, that's also an interesting element of where, not just the United States, but where a lot of societies are going when the state sort of retreats from being active in certain areas yeah. of life, and then the corporation possibly steps in. Like when, I don't know, yeah. at one point we had bookstores, giant chain bookstores, and they were like the new libraries in the United States, at least in New Jersey is how it felt.
Yeah. Borders and stuff like
yeah,
that.
That. Yeah, that was our library yeah. as kids. I mean, we had libraries, but most of us just went to Borders all the time or we had Barnes & Noble. Now that's on the way out. I don't know what will happen, but well, there's the internet. There we go.
Yeah.
But it's these elements of, yeah, if the state isn't doing it, so if your city is not addressing the issue of homelessness, then you may, whether it's a good idea or not, look to a corporation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's also the tax structure that exists, and Netherlands is part of that. Part of that, from what I understand. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a couple countries in the region which have very favorable tax status, and corporations like Apple and Amazon, you know, put a lot of money into places like Ireland where they're taxed at very low rates. Yeah. And, you know, it's if you're a Seattle company and you're making billions of dollars and your bread and butters, you know, came from Seattle, I think you have a moral, ethical obligation to give back to your community in very substantial ways, mm-hmm. you know? And if you're evading taxes, the state doesn't have, you know,
yeah.
it's, I mean, Washington ironically has one of the most regressive tax structures, I think, in the United States.
Huh.
So.
Don't often hear about that, like regressive tax.
Or yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, we have no income tax in the state and sales tax. Mm-hmm. So everything is funded off sales tax or property taxes, which puts a unfair burden on, you know, if you're a millionaire and you buy a pizza, mm-hmm. the sales tax you pay is a lot less of your income than if you make $10 an hour and you buy a pizza. You know, it's a higher percentage, so it's a regressive tax.
Yeah, yeah. I just got a lesson in regressive tax.
Sure.
but yeah, so in terms of, you know, talking about places, we've spoken a little bit about Italy, where you spend much of your year when you're not on the road. I know you do visit the U.S. I mean, that's always going to be a part of your life, I'm sure.
Yep.
And well, Amsterdam, you always come through, I think, but
try.
But you know, it used to be that, and I was of this wave as well. I think you and I both stopped living in the U.S. during the time of George W. Bush.
That was my first real opportunity to get out.
Okay.
Yeah. I lived in London for 6 months, mm-hmm. or Europe, mostly London, but London, Europe.
Yeah, yeah.
For about 7 months.
They used to not separate those two. But we have to now,
yes.
I guess, legally. I don't know. I'll fix this part later.
Right.
London is Europe, UK, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, but the reason I bring this up is because back then it seemed like, oh, the U.S., you know, they sort of elected this guy, and
sure.
and now they're really angry because of this terrible tragedy, and so now they're gonna, you know, I say they, right, the government and the people who yeah. supported it enthusiastically, they're gonna wage war and such, and then it was like, okay, living in Europe will be my another way to live. And in some sense, I won't be part of it. Although I don't know if I knew, if I really believed I wasn't part of it, but at least I wouldn't be there, whatever.
Right.
All these years later, obviously, two presidents, one president has come and gone. Yeah. And then Bush is also gone. But we get this new president who is much, not really new at all in most aspects. Although
yeah.
everyone likes to talk like it's the complete end of the world, but I find something very familiar about this particular man, perhaps because yeah. I grew up in his shadow in some ways. I feel like what we were, if I ever thought, and if you ever thought you were escaping, is not, there is no escape really. I mean,
No. And you know, I post a lot of pretty pictures on Facebook of places we travel,
mm-hmm.
you know, I posted a very scenic picture of Harlem, you know, when we were there. And yeah, it's beautiful. But I also saw a woman hogtied and sedated and dragged off by police because she was having some kind of episode of probably, I don't know, drugs, alcohol.
Was that here?
Something that was in Harlem.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right outside the club we played. Yeah, yeah.
The mentally ill and the sick, the police really love to gang up on them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm coming from the U.S., I thought they treated the situation fairly reasonably and calmly, and you know, no one was murdered.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
No one got shot.
Achievement.
But you know, I mean, people are like, oh, you're so lucky to, and I'm like, yes, I'm very fortunate to be able to do what I'm doing, but I don't romanticize anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, or no. Anything.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you see my pretty pictures on Facebook, but you know, you didn't see the 6-hour traffic and drive I had, you know, to get there, and me peeing in a bottle because we didn't have time to stop,
yeah.
You know, the camper, yeah. You know,
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of amazing things going on in Europe, and there's a lot of awful, terrible institutional problems. And, you know, the rise of the right in Europe is pretty,
ugly.
It's pretty ugly. And it's, I mean, you know, France and Le Pen, you've got stuff going on in Poland with a pretty terrible government there.
We're making a list. Hungary, put that on the list.
Yeah, it's
Netherlands.
Oy. Yeah. There's nowhere to run. There's just different. I mean,
maybe there never was, but I would say less so than ever before, it feels like.
Yeah. But then you look at something like Las Vegas, you know, and there's 58 people murdered at least, and 500 others, you know, injured. And, you know, having a debate with somebody who really believes kind of the propaganda put forth by the NRA about the Second Amendment is, you know, those. I don't think that's going to change people's. There's a core of people,
yeah,
who will never, ever want to give up their guns.
Mm-hmm.
And they've bought into what I think is complete and total propaganda.
It's based off their well-being.
Based off a 250-year-old, you know, completely outdated concept of a well-regulated militia, which, you know, a single person owning 50 assault rifles and going to a hotel tower and you know, raining down on a parade has nothing to do with a well-regulated militia. And that was also part of what was, my understanding was that was to help keep slave, escape slaves, round them up, blah, 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 post.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a different story lesson. But,
You
know, there's certain things like that where it's, you know, prostitution.
Mm-hmm.
Prostitution's never going to be pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think it's always a exploitive sort of, I mean, it's,
you know,
people will argue different ways, but, you know, I think if most women who are working as prostitutes could make 50 or 100 euros an hour doing something else, they probably would.
Okay.
Right. But at least the Netherlands deals with it in a way where, when you make it illegal, like you have in the United States, the susceptibility of women being abused on the streets, in cars, in situations like that, I think is much higher.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying it's a, you know, the ultimate solution, but it's at least there's a mentality where, okay, we can have this, you know, underground economy of marijuana, prostitution, or we can just try and deal with it in a reasonable way.
Yeah.
And you have elements in the United States, like the Christian right or whatever, who will just, they'll never look at anything in a way, which I feel is a logical way to look at things.
Right. Right. You
know?
Yeah.
It's like, oh no, it's just, you know, we just have to ban it completely.
Yeah.
Okay.
Children skip stones. girl said to me,
I was just I'm rewatching Narcos.
Okay.
Have you?
No.
No. But you know what it's about.
Yeah. Pablo Escobar. Yeah. And blah blah blah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, a lot of it is, although all entertaining, because that's part of it. But it's about a war on drugs and how it had very little to do with protecting your children, really.
If any of you get a chance, the History Channel did a 5-part series on the war on drugs that is pretty amazing.
Yeah. And the thing is, I thought that universally, because of facts, I know that facts doesn't mean anything anymore in terms of what's a fact, what isn't. Everyone has competing facts. I understand that. But I had thought that, especially, I don't know, between 2008 and now, it had become clear. The evidence was overwhelming that what they called a war on drugs was, well, nothing beneficial to actual humans.
Yeah.
To a few, you know, whoever benefited in terms of selling arms or
sure.
money. But it's interesting, of course, now you have not just a government, but you have people who like that government who they want to go back to that. They feel like for some reason,
Jeff Sessions,
that was a good time. That was the right thing. A war on drugs is what we need to get back to.
Yeah.
And they, yeah, and they talk about it as people that have not learned or experienced anything. But yeah.
One could almost say it's more sinister than that.
Right. They have learned.
Because they understand exactly what they're doing, and what they're doing is continuing very discriminatory, for lack of a better word, racist policies. Mm-hmm. My understanding of the origins of the war on drugs are Nixon trying to figure out how he could defeat the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement. So by criminalizing drugs, it gave the police and the state the ability to infiltrate these organizations, repress them, split them up, put people in jail, and destroy the movements.
And get popular support for it, because if you call somebody a drug addict, somehow universally, unless you're related to them, and even then, you're universally sort of, everyone's on your side. Like,
yeah.
Get them.
Yeah.
Get them. Get them. They're going to hurt our children.
Yeah. So we have a war on drugs where we treat people who are ill as criminals.
Mm-hmm.
But if we did the same thing with cancer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this person is ill. You know, let's penalize them for being ill instead of helping them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's a mentality that is illogical to me.
Yeah. And the results are evident. I mean,
yeah.
In terms of what you get. Yeah. See, this is an interview, not just about music, but it's about, you know, what you've seen, including while you're on tour, but it can also be when you're not on tour, when you're at home observing the world, because there are so many ways of observing the world these days.
Yeah.
What you gather, what you've learned, especially in these, what I would say are interesting years, living outside of the place where you were raised.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, I've been very fortunate to have the experiences that I've had, traveling, playing music, teaching, and I've tried to take lessons away from all of those things to understand the world. And, you know, I think in my songwriting too, it's, you know, I'm making observations or comments about a lot of the stuff that I've seen, you know, students, workers, you know, homeless people, veterans, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, something that I did last night, and we can see if I can incorporate it into the program. I brought my little experimental recorder made by the nice people at Mic Me, which is a little Kickstarter project in Austria.
Great.
And it's really nice quality audio. So I brought it along yesterday and I recorded some of the songs.
All right.
So I'll see if I can include them here. If anything fails with the, which not going to happen, it's going to be great, but I also can grab one off of one of your
website
latest album. Right.
Yeah sure. If I can. Sure.
Yeah. So I'd be very glad to share your music with the audience. And
great.
And Mike, it's fun to get to share your observations and thoughts with people and to hear them myself here.
Likewise.
In my home.
It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah. Come on back in the spring. We'll do more.
Sounds great. And if you want to check out any of the music, you can go to www.mikespine.com.
There it is. Yeah. All right, good people. I'll take any last minute questions as we wrap it up here. Seton says hello.
Hey, Seton. Great to see you last night.
Yeah. We'll read the comments. Mike will as well. He'll tolerate looking through Facebook for some.
Sounds
if
good.
If you have any questions later. And for those of you who are going to be in Italy.
Yeah, we're back in Milan, Italy on the 10th at Birrificio Lambrate.
How's your Italian?
Terrible.
Better than most, probably.
I learned Spanish before I learned Italian, so I always want to speak in Spanish when I'm supposed to be speaking in Italian.
That's like, you know, it's an effort.
It's similar, but they're definitely two distinct languages.
So if you want to talk to Mike in Spanish, go for it.
Hola.
Good luck. That's it for today. We're out of here. Realities Podcast. It's in all your podcast apps. And we will see Mike again. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you. Ciao.
Cue the outro music. Editing. Post. Mark, I get a note from Glenn. The shadows Oh, yeah, I included this audio that I recorded at the venue where Mike Spine and Barbara Luna played on that fateful day in, that was the end of 2017. Mike Spine will be around in the Netherlands again in just, I think, a month's time. We are in February. So you may hear from him again, hopefully, right back at my kitchen table. And for those who don't know, you can subscribe Citizen Reporter. It's in all the podcast apps. I think you can even tell Alexa to play it, and she will. Oh, I said the name. You know what I mean. The device. Anyway, that's it for today. I'll be back really soon because show 500 is straight ahead. Show 500. Yeah, I'm thinking a lot about it. I'm hatching schemes that will be worthy of a show 500. And then again, trying not to overdo it because what's in a number? What's in a number? Show 500. So I hope you're subscribed. That way you get it automatically. Citizen Reporter. That's the name of the podcast and has been for many, many years. All right. See you soon.